Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
In her award-winning book, This Republic of Suffering, Drew Gilpin-Faust shows us how attitudes on death have changed over time. More recently, we have seen, both nationally and internationally, the legal expansion of the right to medical-assisted death. My guest today is a physician and an expert on the ethics and medicine surrounding medical-assisted death. We explore the intersection of law, medicine, and death next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Stephanie Green. Dr. Green is an author, physician, and internationally recognized expert on the topic of medical-assisted death. Stephanie Green, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Let's start with a review of your professional history and how you arrived at writing the book. This is Assisted Dying, a Doctor's Story of Empowering Patients at the End of Life.
It's never a straight line, is it?
No. Yeah,
I trained to become a physician at McGill University in Montreal. And I specialized in family medicine, but always had a really strong, sometimes exclusive focus on maternity and newborn care. And that's where I spent most of my career. I actually worked in Montreal and Toronto and Victoria, BC, always as an academic clinician, always involved in teaching with residents and students of various disciplines. I really, really loved my career, to be honest. And I've always been drawn to that intersection between medicine, ethics, and law. And I was able to kind of feed that interest through women's health and reproductive medicine. But like most Canadians, I was following a story unfolding in our headlines where the prohibition of assisted dying in Canada was challenged through the courts. And I was first exposed to that as a medical student with the story of Sue Rodriguez, and then later on through the Carter case, after I'd been practicing for 20 years. So when in 2015, our Supreme Court came up with a decision that the prohibition of assisted dying should be addressed. It should no longer exist. That certain patients in certain situations should be allowed access to an assisted death. I was very curious about that, and I wondered who would do that work. To make a very long story short, after some education and some interest in the topic, especially driven by my kind of strong belief in the notion of patient-centered care, this seemed like a really good example of patient-centered care. I wondered who would do this work. I thought I might be interested in it, and I jumped into it in June of 2016. And I met some really remarkable people doing this work. The people coming forward and asking in those early days were very courageous, very committed, and quite unique individuals. And one of the people I met was a remarkable man named John Shields. And I'll mention his name because his story ended up being told in the New York Times Sunday edition in May of 2017. Really a remarkable story about a remarkable man. And of course, I had been mentioned in the story as his practitioner. And through the vision of an insightful literary agent, like a movie scene, after that story came out, I received a phone call, a cold call from a literary agent in New York asking me if I'd be interested in writing a book. It never happens that way, right? But that's the way it happened for me. I thought it was a joke at first, and then it wasn't. And I'll save you the ins and outs of what happened for the next few years, but essentially the rest is history. That's how I came to write a book.
Well, you are certainly the envy of authors all over after that story. How was the process of writing the book? Did you find it difficult, interesting, surprising?
Yeah, in retrospect, it was more challenging than I thought it would be. I do like to write for myself, keep a journal. I hadn't done that consistently or anything, but when I started the work in assisted dying, I was really struck by just the extraordinary circumstances I found myself in. And I did find myself making notes or writing things down about anecdotes, about things I had seen or experienced or heard or felt. It was impossible not for me to do that. And so I thought I had the material and the ability to do this, and I like to think I do, but it's actually very difficult to write a book, and to write a book that flows well requires time and effort. But I did find the experience a little bit, not cathartic, but like reflective. It really forces you to think about why something stood out in your mind and what about it was so striking to you. And I really enjoyed that aspect of it, but it was a lot harder than I expected. And it took a lot longer than I expected.
Well, the end product is phenomenal, as attested to by all the wonderful reviews you have on public sites that people can go see. As you know, Dr. Green, this is the podcast of the American Association for Physician Leadership, and the membership of the organization is physicians and healthcare managers. What should physicians in leadership positions know about medical assisted dying?
Well, that's a great question. I actually think leaders and managers really need to be up to date with some good foundational knowledge. When I began this work in 2016, there were 6 countries outside of Canada where some form of assisted dying was permitted. There were 5 states within the U.S. Today, we're 8 years later, and there's arguably 17 countries with court decisions or legislation either implemented or pending implementation allowing some form of assisted dying. And there's currently 11 jurisdictions within the U.S. alone that allow assisted dying in some form. So that's a significant change in a short period of time. And of course, many of your listeners will know that all of this actually began in the state of Oregon, which began allowing assisted dying back in 1997. I think it's easier for me to say that, you know, assisted dying is permitted in all of Canada, in every province, in every territory. It's regulated by federal legislation. It's an exemption of our criminal code. It came about through a constitutional court challenge. So it's kind of a simple thing to explain. That's not how it came about in the United States. And I'll save you the ins and outs of all of that, except to say it's kind of decided on a state-by-state basis at this point. And each state has its own variation of a similar law. So we can get into what those are, who's eligible and who's not. It depends on how much you want to know about all that. I'm happy to get into that with you.
That's an interesting point. Let's, if you would, describe to me the eligibility of a patient, and does that eligibility vary between some of the states in the U.S. versus Canada?
So there are some significant differences between the countries, which we can easily get to. I think there's more in common than there is different. And certainly between the different states, there's much more common. So there are small variances, but essentially there's several things that are required in every jurisdiction. You know, every patient needs to be over 18 years of age. Every patient needs to have decision-making capacity. Every patient in the United States needs to be terminally ill, which is defined as a prognosis of 6 months or less. And that is a difficult thing to determine. And every patient in the U.S. needs to be able to take the medication because it is self-administered in the United States everywhere. So regarding the practice itself, you know, the clinician, the treating clinician needs to verify all of this eligibility criteria. They need to inform the patient of the risks and the benefits and the alternatives and confirm that this is a well-considered and voluntary request. So that those things need to be true in every place. And there's a process involved as well. So some of the differences would be in some of the process. So, you know, every application for assisted dying in the United States requires 2 oral requests, 2 verbal requests to die, and 1 written request. And as I mentioned, the patients need to take the drugs themselves. So there are differences in things like the waiting times between the requests, the mandated waiting time after a written request. Most states, it's about 15 days, after you make an oral request. But in some, it's longer. In Hawaii, it's 20. In California, changed it to be 48 hours. So there's small differences like that you'll see state to state. And obviously, if you're working within a certain jurisdiction, you'd have to know the detail of that jurisdiction. The main difference I would just point out from Canada, the 2 things that stand out the most is that in Canada, a patient does not need to be terminally ill to qualify for assisted dying. That's a significant difference. The presence of intolerable suffering is really what's central to some of our eligibility, and that may or may not be with a terminally ill patient. And of course, in Canada, the patient may either take the medication themselves or it can be administered by a clinician. So clinician-administered assisted dying is actually by far the more common occurrence in Canada. In fact, in Canada, it's 99.9% of all assisted dying is clinician-administered. So a significant difference there.
Do the medications vary because of the requirement that the patient must him or herself take the medication?
Well, yes. If the patient's taking the medication themselves, like in the United States, it's traditionally an oral medication. It's something they need to drink. As it turns out, there's been some creativity for good reason. You can imagine not everybody can hold a cup or swallow or use their gastrointestinal system. So depending on the state and how the law is written, it tends to use words like ingest in California. So feeding tubes could be used and even rectal tubes have been used. So as long as it's using the gastrointestinal tract. So the medications, of course, would be different for that than if it was intravenous. And there's been a challenge in the United States. The medications that I think were desired and used in the early days are not easily supplied or available in the United States anymore due to a variety of reasons. And so they've had to come up with more of like a cocktail of different drugs, which are arguably more challenging.
That's interesting. You've described at least briefly the process that a patient would have to go through to become approved. How long does that process take?
Yeah, well, that's a difficult question to answer. It really depends on the mandated waiting times and the process in the jurisdiction itself. So that's a harder question to answer. I have data mostly from Canada, which again is different. Certainly in Canada, most cases happen within the first 30 days of the request. And I think that's probably true in the United States, but I don't have that data at the tip of my tongue. We do know that only about 70% of patients who make a request and are given a prescription in the United States actually end up taking the medication. So there are certainly lots of examples of people becoming qualified, getting the prescription, picking up the medication, and then hanging on to it for some time. So there can be quite a variability in the time.
Are there enough providers to handle the individuals wanting assistance in dying? It strikes me this could be a right without a practical application.
Yeah, I think that's a really big obstacle, really, one of the obstacles to access is the number of clinicians willing to do the work. And there's certainly not enough. Again, my personal experience is in the Canadian system, and we've had an embracing of the notion of assisted dying by the Canadian public. Over 80% of the public consistently year after year after year has approved of this. And the demand has grown through the years. We are having trouble keeping up with the number of people who are interested because we don't have enough clinicians. I would imagine that is very much the case in the United States, where there are less jurisdictions, less public knowledge, less talking about it. And less clinicians willing to wade into the work. There's also a difference in the United States. In most states, it's only doctors that can do this work. There are now in New Mexico, of course, advanced practice nurse practitioners are also allowed, and in other states are trying to expand that to other clinicians like nurse practitioners to do the work. So in Canada, actually, I think 7% of all assisted dying is done by nurse practitioners. So I think that kind of expansion of scope of practice can be helpful to address this.
You mentioned wait time by legislation, typically what is required under law. And I know that it varies, but maybe you can give me a range.
So in a state like California, I believe you can have an overlap of some of the waiting times. So between the oral requests is now down to 48 hours. I believe the written request can be done at the same time. So things can be condensed and move quickly. This is not an attempt to push people through a system. Let me clarify that a significant portion of patients, about 35% of patients, will die while waiting for this care or will lose capacity while waiting for this care because they often present quite late for a number of reasons. So this reduction of waiting times that's kind of been encouraged and now allowed in a place like California has been to the benefit of the patient who's asking for the care. So it can be quite short, Other places like the state of Hawaii, you know, there's a mandatory 20-day waiting period between oral requests. So, it's going to be quite a bit longer. And I don't know the mandatory waiting time after the written request in Hawaii, actually, that I'm less familiar with. So, you know, I would say as short as a few days, as long as several weeks, and those are minimum times. That's after you found the clinician and you know, started the paperwork.
Very interesting. Physicians are being asked by patients about medical assisted dying and other options, talking about going out of the country, for example, to Switzerland. How should physicians prepare to address these patient inquiries?
Yeah, this can be very challenging, of course, for physicians on several levels. I think when faced with a request from a patient for an assisted death, doctors have to respond professionally. They have to respond compassionately. They need to continue to support their patients for their ongoing care and treatment, regardless of this type of request. You know, even if this is something you're not going to be counseling a patient about or investigating, I think there's a whole host of care that a clinician still needs to provide as a professional obligation. I should clarify that in Canada, it's actually not permitted by law to counsel someone to suicide. You cannot suggest it or encourage it in any way. It's a criminal offense. But a conversation to explore what the patient is asking for, why they are asking for it, why now, what has changed, what resources have they accessed, what resources could they still be accessing and could be offered to them. Those are really important questions and really important conversations that doctors need to be having with patients who step forward with this type of request. Trying to understand the conundrum faced by the patient, as in all forms of medical care. Now, in the U.S., I know that even in states where assisted dying is or, you know, even isn't allowed, having a discussion with someone about what they're requesting and why or about their thoughts about assisted dying is not criminal. The discussion itself is not considered assisting someone to die. So you can entertain a conversation, as far as I understand, with a patient who wants to talk about this. But I think in states where it's not allowed, you probably need to be careful to avoid any action that's really considered to be assisting or encouraging the suicide while you're still acting professionally and compassionately with your patient.
Dr. Green, I was not going to ask this question for fear that you or others might find it inappropriate, but perhaps my age has overcome my discretion. How are professional fees charged for this typically? And can you go through the economics of this from a provider point of view?
Right. So, it's typically not discussed much. It's an interesting question, actually. I don't mind getting into it. It is, of course, going to be significantly different between our countries. We have different medical systems. I would say, just to set the foundation, in Canada, of course, we have universal health care. When a physician offers medical service to a patient, the provincial health plan is billed for that. And there's a fee code basically established for every action that we do. If I take your blood pressure, that's a fee code. If I, you know, do cardiac surgery, there's a fee code. Sure. So when I'm addressing someone who's applied for an assisted death, there is actually a fee code for an assessment. And there's a fee code for a provision with a few little tweaks here and there. So it's essentially no different. It's a covered legal medical service in Canada. We can argue about whether the fee codes are, you know, adequate or not, but that's not really your question. Let's just say I won't retire on it. In the United States, of course, it's a very different system, and I have less experience with that. Some of my colleagues in the United States, I am aware of how they do this work, and I guess I don't know if it changes state to state, but they have set fees that they charge usually for a package of care rather than breaking it down for bits and pieces. This is kind of whole person care, often involving not just the doctor, but there can be social workers and pharmacists and other, you know, this requires a team of professionals to do properly and to do well. So, for example, I have colleagues in California that will offer kind of a complete package of care for a set fee, regardless of how long that takes or how many weeks or months it takes to unfold.
Interesting. Thank you. In the U.S., end-of-life doulas seem to be growing in popularity. How does this trend impact medically assisted dying?
Yeah, we've seen the same thing in Canada. There's been a real growth in end-of-life doulas and programs and people interested in getting into this work. Not surprising to me. I think doulas, just like birth doulas, you know, doulas are meant to help guide patients through a process that they're maybe less familiar with, right? To fill in some knowledge gaps, to help guide them through something they're less familiar with. We've become quite removed from the dying process, right? 100 years ago, most people in North America died at home, right? We had a certain familiarity with it, what to expect. But more recently, modern medicine has, which has been fabulous and saved many lives. I'm all good with that, but it's removed death from the community for the most part and really brought it into the hospital system over the past century. And there's been many good things about that, but one of the outcomes is that it's left us unfamiliar with death and the dying process, and that has left most people quite fearful of it and really unsure of how to manage it. So I think the role of end-of-life doulas can be to educate people, to help them plan for their end-of-life experience, to help demystify some of that. To support them through that process, through planning and knowledge. So I think there's a real role for that.
Can patients elect to be organ donors if they were to qualify and yet still go through medically assisted dying?
So another great question. Actually, in several jurisdictions in the world, that is possible. In Canada, we are doing organ donation after MAID. The process of qualifying for organ donation is kept completely separate from the process of planning for end of life. The two should not be impacting each other. But once someone is determined to be eligible for MAID, if they bring up the issue of organ donation, if they're interested in it, they can be referred to a transplant service to find out if they're qualified for that or not. And we've certainly had a fair bit of experience in Canada now, especially in Ontario and British Columbia doing that. As far as I know, there is no jurisdiction in the United States that allows organ donation after assisted dying. I don't think it's ever been done in the United States.
Earlier in the interview, you talked about patients' capacity, their ability to remain cognitive and express their desires and their consent to go forward with the process. It strikes me that a number of patients in that phase of a later illness might lose cognition or not be able to give consent.
Yeah.
Do they lose the right to medically assisted dying? Is there any advanced directive that says if I'm this is what I want if I'm unable to express it?
Well, that seems to be something that the population very much wants. It's a very strong desire. If you look at polls in a number of countries, if you ask people if they want the ability to make an advanced request and to give advanced consent for assisted dying, there's strong support for that. It doesn't exist in many places. It does not exist anywhere in the United States. It does not currently exist anywhere in Canada, although one of our provinces has passed legislation to allow it starting June of 2025. If not sooner, it's currently actually in the news this week. And there are jurisdictions in Europe that allow that. But the way it stands right now, there's no ability to make an advanced request and give advanced consent for assisted dying in the United States. Interestingly, though, and this comes off as a bit of a criticism, but so I don't mean it necessarily to be as such. But in the United States, of course, with the requirement for patients to self-administer, this process unfolds when a patient makes an application, is found eligible, we'll say, a prescription is written, and the patient or the family picks up the medication for the patient, who then takes it home and then has the ability to use it. I'm not aware of any program that limits the amount of time that they can use that. And so this can sit on the shelf for quite some time in their closet, while they decide if they're really in need of it. And I think there is a gap in the system where somebody could potentially lose capacity during that time. And then I'm not sure who's responsible for what happens to that medication What if the patient has lost capacity and does not have a full understanding of what that medication is or does? I think there is potential for harm and things not going the way that it was planned. It's not planned for that, but I could see a conundrum.
I could see a bar exam question, actually. It would be horrific. As our time together draws to a close, I want to recommend your book. This is Assisted Dying, A Doctor's Story of Empowering Patients at End of Life. Is there a professional society for practitioners that assist patients with dying?
So, yeah, for clinicians who are interested in learning more about what this topic is and what this practice is, there are two groups that I would recommend. One will be less interesting to your American colleagues, but the Canadian Association of MAID Assessors and Providers is a national organization that supports the people that do this work. And we have educational opportunities and resources publicly available on our website, CAMAPCanada.ca. It's the first group globally to organize in that manner. There is a very similar group which came up in the United States called ACAMAID, they are extremely helpful in informing clinicians and those involved or interested in learning more about this work in the United States.
My guest has been Dr. Stephanie Green. The book is This is Assisted Dying, A Doctor's Story of Empowering Patients at the End of Life. Stephanie Green, thank you so much for your time and important work.
Thank you for your time and your interest in the topic.
My thanks to Stephanie Green for her time and insights. Her book, This is Assisted Dying, A Doctor's Story of Empowering Patients at the End of Life, is a work of a physician leader and of compassion. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpracticepodcast.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpracticepodcast.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org. That is holy cow, Batman and Robin. Ripple Kapow.